Oh, that's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful music. And I hope you enjoyed that. I happen to like the shekere, which is essentially a gourd with beads. It's an African instrument, and it is just expertly played there by percussionist and musicologist and arranger and an activist, actually, as well. Chaz Mortimer of Portland, Oregon, and it's titled Three Shekeres and a Bell. He runs a program out there in Portland, Oregon, called Beats, Lyrics, and Leaders that mentors young people in traditional African and Afro-Cuban traditional and jazz forms. He regularly performs with a variety of artists and heads up his own group, Fingerpaint Afro Jazz. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, August the 20th, 2015. And in the second half of our program, we'll be taking your political temperature. Just how is this 2016 presidential race, such as it is, resonating with you? And at what point would you say the temperature is? Are you hot about it, warm about it, cool, cold? What is it that you're feeling? We'll take your temperature in the second half of the program. But in the first part of the program, let's talk about this problem that simply will not go away, at least it's so it seems, and that is the issue of these police killings. Just last night in St. Louis, Missouri, we had another black teenager shot and killed, and it has been the reason for renewed protest in St. Louis. Now, according to the police chief, 18-year-old Mansour Ball Bay was shot and killed after fleeing a house where two white police officers were conducting a search. And supposedly, at least this is according to the police chief Dotson, he pointed a gun at them, two police officers, and they fired at him, killing him. And this happened, of course, 1 year, as you know, after local protests erupted over the killing of Kajimi Powell in St. Louis and Michael Brown in nearby Ferguson and on the outskirts of St. Louis. The question really deals with this perpetual problem that isn't going away. When we talk about police use of force, we know that it is race-based, and this is not conjecture. We know that there are enough statistics and reports and studies that have substantiated that claim, that there is a racial dynamic that is undeniable when it comes to police use of force, police brutality, police killings. And we still are hearing, you know, month after month, we get the tally, and it is increasing to the point where I think if something isn't done soon in a serious way, we are asking for a major, major conflagration over this issue. Now, this is not to say that there aren't times when we will see these reports, and they are occurring in very questionable circumstances, very contentious circumstances. And if you talk to police officers, I talked with one just yesterday and talked about the violence that police officers are experiencing even among themselves, this issue of in fact, including suicide, that many police officers who are coming into the force are coming in with a lot of baggage, unattended to for years and years and years. And when you compound these attitudes with the standing racial attitudes that have shaped the society and that continue to shape the society, we're talking about some really important problems here. And
it cannot just simply be a matter of, well, we'll change things administratively, or maybe it's more training, or maybe it's, you know, body cameras, or maybe it's some kind of a heavier recruitment effort to get more people of color on the force. And all of these things are basically ignoring the critical issue here. And the critical issue is that we live in an apartheid country. And the apparatus of government and the agencies of government are reflecting that. In fact, this is how the system uses these different methods and agencies and systems of control to ensure this rotten core of America, where we have this differentiation at every single level. I'm having a big problem with this notion that, well, we have to have people killed, especially African Americans, Latinos. We have to have that happen in order to get, quote, reform, administrative changes, as if this is about administration, paperwork, you know, new forms to fill out, new gadgets, and that this would change the nature of the relationship between police and communities, when we know that the nature of the relationship between police and communities is forged in the fire and the crucible of trenchant racism in this country. And whereas you may have policing in white communities, you have law enforcement in communities of color. Two entirely different dispositions, because the intention from the word go was to design it that way. You must have utter and complete control over the undesirables, and they create a situation where the communities that they are policing are seen as petri dishes full of bacteria. These are not communities, thriving communities with human beings in them. This is a bacteria. And the job of the police is to contain the spread or potential spread. Keep them penned in, keep them under heavy, heavy surveillance, heavy manners, as they say in the Caribbean. Keep them under heavy manners. Because these people, and people who live in communities like these, but this goes all the way back to the formation of our country, where you have license to do anything. Because the people that you are doing these things to they're not people. So this is what explains when you have a police officer on the force, say, for 5 to 7 years, which is, I mean, from 0 to 7 years on the police force is the time when you have to watch folks who are going to behave very badly. Statistically, at least in New York City, I did my own study of that. Looking at official figures of the age of police officers and the age and race of the victims who were shot and otherwise killed by police, you get to see that in the vast majority of cases, the police doing the killings not only were overwhelmingly white. Overwhelmingly, they were white. And overwhelmingly, they were on the force between 0 and 7 years. That's statistically established. Now, what does that say? Is it a training issue? Well, some people would say it is. It means that they really need to learn a little bit more about this business of policing, and especially when lethal force is either called for or used. However, we can also say that in these cases where we have these killings, and they usually are with officers on the force for 0 to 7 years, and it happens, by the way, that this killing of Mansour Balbay in St. Louis, the police officers involved, they have not been named yet, were both on the force for 7 years. It means that there's a culture that they come from that informs them about their behavior with respect to the communities they're serving. There's a culture that comes from that informs their conduct, their thinking, and their actions and behavior. And then there's a culture that they come to. That is the police culture, which is an extension of the larger culture. And in both cultures, the thinking is the same. The thinking is the same in both cultures as to how you regard these communities. I would venture, I'm not an expert here, but I'm giving you, I think, an educated opinion. The culture is the problem here. The culture is so weird, so wrong, so antithetical to the lofty goals and objectives of policing. But the culture, whether they're coming from it or coming into it, the culture is perfectly in line with the culture that existed at the formation of these systems of control. The culture of the police department is absolutely in sync with white supremacist thinking in the United States. No different. So when we are told, well, it's a matter of body cameras, it's a matter of a bit more training, it is a matter of better screening, all this kind of stuff, we know that this is just not making sense. Because overwhelmingly, the results are exactly the same. They're the same in St. Louis. They're the same in New York. They're the same in Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Cleveland, Ohio. You take any city, their results are exactly the same. Overwhelmingly, white officers, white male officers, overwhelmingly Black Latino victims. So when you see this uniformity of results, you have to put it into the mix. Maybe that is the problem. Maybe it's not a matter of training. You can't train somebody who has been indoctrinated into a belief system and into a system of operating just in everyday life. You will have to do one heck of a job to undo all of that nasty thinking. And you will have to now present the alternative, which will, you can't avoid it. You will now have to present that as the truth, as the reality. It is the truth. A Latino in East Harlem is as valuable, has as valuable a life as a person living in Mineola, Long Island. Now, that is a truth. But in policing, it isn't the truth, is it? In our day-to-day understanding of how this country works, it is not the truth, is it? A Black kid going to neighborhood school has the same chance of education as a white kid going to a private school or even a public school. It's not the same, is it? But they keep telling us this. And so the problem with education, as if mirroring the same dynamic as a problem with policing, the problem with education is now educators. Not the system, but the people delivering educational services and in one way or the other implementing the dictates of the state with regard to the policies that they should follow and the testing that they should do and the grading and how you get the schools rated. We are constantly in this battle. Now, the specifics of this police killing in St. Louis still have to be ferreted out. We don't know all of the details yet. We only know what the police chief reports. But already you can see a remarkable similarity with how we get to know about these things. And it is, in my mind, it is unbelievable, really, that this country has not yet erupted in just out-and-out rage. How long will this go on? How long will they pretend that this is a matter of training and of body cameras and, you know, all of that stuff? And even if they insist it's about training and body cameras, the people who are on the receiving end of this violence, the communities that are on the receiving end of this, can't afford to continue to believe this. They have to organize with this reality in mind. They have to do it. Because what I'm pointing to here is that the system, as I've constantly said on this program, if you understand systems and how they work, this is scientific. This is not incidental or just, you know, now for now and then they change and whatnot. The essential purpose, intent, vision, these things are set in stone. They have organized systems so that their so-called core values, you hear this a lot, core values, these are their core values. This is this society's core values. And their values are quite antithetical to what we would call humanitarianism. They're not human. They're not humane. They are simply about creating out of the heads of Zeus, I guess, the head of Zeus, a fictional existence. But they have the power, they have the authority, and they have all of the trappings to enforce that power and authority to shape a reality that they would like. And the reality that they have, you know, the word patrolman or patrol is itself derived from slavery days when you had what were then called the patterollers. These would be the people who would be rolling out of various plantations hired by plantation owners to listen for and track down the pattering feet of fleeing slaves and to bring them back, dead or alive. So the very word patrolman or patrolling is deeply ingrained in the psychotic, racist history of this country. And from the very beginning, it had to do with containing specifically slaves, but not only slaves, because you had white working class people, you had white slaves, you had Native Americans who were a threat to this country, they said, because after all, their job was to simply submit and let the settlers come in and take all the land, take everything on it, over it, under it, around it, and claim it as their own, and subjugate them, and drive them off their land, and do this kind of thing repeatedly, ad infinitum, because the minute they landed here in the United States, the program was set. Before they even got here, they knew that whoever they met, would be inferior to them, and really not even human. And at that time, the explanation was the Bible gave them the authority to say that. In England, there was a big discussion. It was the source of major contention. Very, very spiritual people were then debating the nigger question, as they called it. What should we do with these people who are really very annoying by staging these rebellions all throughout our colonies? What shall we do with them? Do they not understand that their role is to submit? Do they not understand that they're lower than animals? Do they not understand that God ordained their inferior status in perpetuity? Do they not understand this? Well, then we'll have to set up systems that not only give them the message, but that enforce it. And the evolution of that way of thinking is our police department. That's the way of thinking. Now, you would think that this is only applying to, you know, when we talk about the racial divide, and we're talking the black-white racial divide. No, no, no. It's a system. It couldn't care less whether you put on their uniform and you're Latino or you're Haitian or whatever. They don't care about that. You will buy into the culture. You will be enculturated. Thank God. We have had many instances and discussions on this program where we have, even within the department, fights all the time. Latino officers, Asian officers, African-American officers who led the way in this regard of maintaining their humanity, maintaining a sense of what it means to be of service to a community, and distancing themselves from that way of thinking. But they're up against a mighty, mighty wall. The culture of policing is one that is racist, race-based. And I invite anybody to contradict that statement. I invite somebody to prove me wrong. It doesn't matter whether your police chief is African American or Latino or Asian. It's in the same light. It doesn't matter whether your president of the United States is African American, Latino, or Asian. It doesn't matter. The system, they must prove themselves subservient to the system. They must be pledged to continue the system. Where does that leave so-called advocates? And where does that leave the communities that are affected? What do they do to organize a counter system? This is a very tough challenge. We've gotten enough reports. We don't need any more reports. It's already established. We get the picture. But the reports are useful for political reasons. You know, they get to say, well, we've studied the problem, and we have here's a 500-page report. It doesn't do a thing at all about addressing the root cause of most of America's problems, certainly at the social level. And that's white supremacy. And the vestiges of it. We have not moved one inch from that discussion. We haven't moved from square one. And we are not going to move from square one in a hurry. It will not be in the interest of a system to engage in meaningful discussion and debate about why it needs to jettison these archaic, racist ways of operating, this enforcement of apartheid in America. They're not going to have these kinds of discussions. So what, therefore, is the alternative? This is the big question. I don't know what the alternative is, except I think the first thing we can do is get real about where we are. This is a theme of mine. You got to be real. What are we dealing with here? Is this policing? Yeah, in a way it's policing. But in a fundamental way, we're talking about the same old story. Why do blacks and Latinos dominate as victims of police lethal use of force and brutality and unconstitutional actions and prosecutorial misconduct? The whole law enforcement apparatus, why is it that we have more blacks and Latinos in prison? We have unequal sentencing guidelines and laws and unequally applied guidelines and laws. The whole thing is predicated on that primordial command. You will keep communities of color in check by force or by any other means. This society requires it. Now, we have some internal issues also to deal with, and that concerns what is happening within our communities. These communities that are super stressed because they are super targeted. And more we see signs of self, what Amos Wilson calls self-annihilation. People turning rage and anger and violence onto themselves. Doing the handiwork of their oppressors. This is a natural consequence of how things are designed. The systems that are designed produce these things as natural byproducts. All the more reason for our communities to wake up, our advocates to really ramp up their advocacy, our leaders to take new tacts in leading, our people to take action in devising systems that work against or that counter the intended purpose of these agencies. That's really where we need to be, it seems to me. We've gone past the point of discussing formalities like, you know, should we fill out this form or should we have a new form or should we have a new agency to supervise the agency that used to supervise that other agency? Should we have more meetings to have more meetings and then, you know, have another meeting to discuss the meetings that we had about the previous meetings? We've gone through all of that. It's done. We should decide it's done. It's time to deal. If they don't want to deal with it, and it's not in the interest of the system to deal with it, I'm saying it is time for us as communities to begin to deal with this problem in a manner that assures or is in some way confluent with our survival, literally our survival. That is not the work that they have to do. They don't have to do that. That is the responsibility of these communities to build and construct systems of survival at every single level. To look to the government. I'm just talking on a logical level here. To look to the people oppressing you to articulate some method of not oppressing you. I mean, what kind of logic is that? What new medication are you on if you're thinking that way? No, that is not their job. They're doing their job and doing it very well. They're achieving exactly the results. In fact, they're overachieving in terms of the results that they seek. They're doing extremely well. The system is working fine. It is working perfectly. The question is, what is your system? And when are you going to put something together that says this is something that we have to adopt in order to survive, in order for us to continue? When we look at the statistics, we see plainly that it is not happenstance that this is occurring. It is not by, you know, just coincidence that this is happening. It is planned. It is enculturated. It is imbued. It is part of these agencies, and this is the culture, which is an extension. And by extension, I just don't mean, you know, the lateral extension. I'm talking over time. We're talking now since the 1600s. And certainly by now, we should have come to some kind of conclusion that, you know, this is not rash judgment. The statistics are there. The evidence is there. The personal knowledge is there. We have all we need to conclude, reasonably conclude, that somebody's out to do us in. Now, if in recognition of that reality, we are still now looking to have parleys and discussions with the people trying to do us in as to how they might, you know, tweak things a little bit so that they may work a little more efficiently, well, you're crazy. So this is the work we have to do. This is where we have to get to. We have to begin the process of recognizing the reality that we are living and planning something that has to do with our survival and our benefit. I'll take this break and come back to taking your political temperature right after this. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and I thought we would, you know, we have to keep taking our temperature, you know, whenever you're sick, they take your temperature repeatedly at different points just to find out if there's a change. I think we ought to do the same. Many developments since we last took our temperature about the political race, the presidential race of 2016 and how it's shaping up, and coverage of that race and the so-called contestants in that race. But more so, I'm interested in what your attitudes are, not what's going on with them. I mean, they're doing their thing. But what is there a change since the last time we spoke with regard to your attitudes about this race and your attitudes toward politics, your attitudes about the parties, the different candidates and their so-called positions? What are you thinking? And more importantly, what are you likely to do with what are you thinking? You know, what options do you see yourself having given where we are right now? Your calls at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. Let's start in New York with Ma'at. You're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon, Utrice, and to the family.
Thank you.
I want to find out if you have, I think you should have a YouTube channel where you put all of your, all of these, I mean, I just my mouth is somewhat agape because it's just so brilliant, your, your analysis of our situation. And I would like to, do you have a YouTube channel where someone could go and get to the, all your police, commentaries and when you have Alton on? Do you have that now?
No.
Well, I think somebody needs to step forward, you know, who's savvy and needs to get that going ASAP. But as to this, you want to comment about this whole presidential fiasco?
What is your attitude right now? What is your political temperature? Are you warm, lukewarm, hot? Cold.
I think Gerald Celente says it best. He says when it comes to politics, he's an atheist. Okay. and not otherwise, but when politics, yes. I mean, you have clowns, freaks, knaves, and fools, reprobates, and don't forget murderers and thieves. So, yes, Virginia. There really is what they refer to as being the luminous, the shining ones. There's a door behind the door behind the door in terms of who controls all of this presidential nonsense and freak show. So I think we have to put more focus because we don't select any of those people. And Utrice, you need to do something on Donald Trump and his full-page ad, because I believe you were at the, you were covering the Central Park situation, and
oh, yes.
He was asking for the death penalty against a young man that, of course, turned out to be innocent and, you know, served long terms, and he was calling for the death penalty when there wasn't a murder, and it's just the death penalty is just problematic all around. I think we're 48% of his customers, but I want to hear some other attitudes. But we're dealing with the shining ones, and it's like in the Wizard of Oz, you know, the guy that you couldn't see, and that's what we need to have more focus on. I'll listen to your comments over the radio.
All right,
here.
Thank you for calling and contributing today. Thank you, Los Angeles. Ron, you're on the air.
Good morning, Latrice.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. I was wondering, all of the bashing against Black Lives Matter, in particular the situation where the activists had the exchange with presidential candidate Hillary. I think they did a credible interchange in where, they let the world know that Clinton and Hillary have been actively responsible for major aspects of the killer industrial or prison industrial complex, the differences in income, and just a lot of the suffering that the African-American community has had over various years. And just because they didn't shout in her face and was somewhat parliamentary and somewhat humble in their presentation, they still got their point across. And I think also, too, in contrast, Hillary was very somewhat condescending. And you could see, as an African-American, She in no way she has our interests. In no way does she respect us, et cetera. And I was just curious, what was your take on that specific interchange?
Well, you know, I see the Black Lives Matter movement as exactly that. It's a movement. And they moved into a vacuum of leadership. Now, they've gotten a lot of criticism for the way they've handled things, but people have to accept the fact that they are operating within an environment that they construe to be a crisis. And their actions, whether people approve of them or not, and you know, if all in the world were normal, we'll say, well, okay, we could check them on this, but all in the world is not normal, and they are
correct
taking action according to what they see as a crisis in the country that is being ignored. On another level, I want to point out that the actions of Black Lives Matter is not coming with, and believe me, I don't want to criticize them because they're doing what they can. And that's, I'm really cognizant of that. They're doing what they can to advance this issue, and they're taking a particular tactic on it. It's not violent, but it is disruptive, and that's because mm-hmm. they need to get attention. And their disruption is no different, in my view, than Donald Trump's outrageous campaign, where he's, you know, today he's attacking the Pope and you know, just being obnoxious and ridiculous. But they have a point to make, and they're doing their work. What I was hoping for, and this is, and it's a start, is that there is no cudgel here. What is the cudgel? Other than saying, okay, we are bringing awareness. And perhaps that's, if they serve that purpose alone, perhaps they're doing their job, okay? Because nobody else is doing it at that level. But I keep Correct. Pointing to the fact that we got to have a cudgel. Black Lives Matter, or else what? Or else what? What are you going to do? What is the plan?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, idea, this is, Alton Maddox talks all the time about, you know, the idea that you have to have some facility with two things. You have to have military science, and you got to have, you've got to have a cudgel that compels mm-hmm. these people to listen. And I'm waiting to see if there's a group that would say Black Lives Matter. And, or else, this is what is going to happen. There will be no voting. We will begin a vigorous campaign asking people not to vote. You know, mm-hmm. we have to have a cudgel. So that's my only observation. And I say that, you know, the actions of Black Lives Matter should tell us what is really the depths to which the Black leadership has sunk. The official leadership mm-hmm. has just completely walked off the job here. And they have joined forces with systems that are doing their folks in. And they, you know, they're having all these bureaucratic meetings, and they're having conventions, and they, you know, attending all these lovely little galas and dinner parties. But the real street work mm-hmm. that needs to be done is organizing communities. And so we'll see whether anybody steps up to the plate and delivers the cudgel.
Well, thanks, okay, Ron, in terms of the cudgel.
Yeah.
Yes. In terms of the cudgel, the one of the sisters that was involved with the disruption of the Bernie Sanders, she did an extensive interview after that on a Black podcast, I think the following day or following 2 days. And one of the things that she did say, one of the goals is to destroy the Democratic Party. So,
well,
so
I think we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. But I really, I'm not of the view that they shouldn't have done what they did. I believe that they did what they did in crisis mode, and it required crisis mm-hmm. action to get attention. They were not violent, which was very important. They did not incite mm-hmm. violence, and they're not inciting
correct.
Violence. So they correct. Are they're doing what is political action, and it's
correct.
Par for the course in this environment, I think. Thank you, Ron, for your call mm-hmm. today. Thanks for contributing. From New York, Bernie, you're on the air.
Hi, Adrian. Thanks for taking
hi.
My call.
Hi, how are you?
Oh,
there's a lot of interference we're getting. Are you driving? Oh, okay. We'll hear from Bernie, hopefully, again. Okay, from Brooklyn. David, you're on the air.
David, I'm calling from Brooklyn.
Yes,
and,
indeed.
You know, I'm very disappointed with what's going on with the people in power, like de Blasio, the mayor, and the Negro politicians and other people of color in the city council. Recently, they agreed to hire about 15 more patrolmen, or slave patrolmen, as we some of us call it.
Actually, 1,500.
I mean, I think that is absolutely ridiculous. We don't need any more police. We need the things that are going to benefit our community. For example, in a black community, people need jobs. There's no reason that that money that they're spending for 1,500 more police persons could be used for jobs for adults and young people in the community here in New York, rather than just socialist control with the police department. I'm very disappointed with all those Negroes sitting in city council that go along with this nonsense of hiring 1,500 more police.
Now, if the argument were made to you that, well, this is in fact a way of making communities of color safer, what do you say to that?
No, I don't think that makes them safer. I think to make things safer, you make certain people have jobs. You do things that are beneficial to people on the social end, not the repression of the slave patrols, or i.e. police department. So we need to have that money spent on social things like employment for people and the all kinds of public service jobs that could be created to give people who don't have jobs to make the social conditions better in the community.
Well, what is it, your temperature with respect to the 2016 presidential race now? I mean, we'll be coming back to it as things develop. Since the last time we talked, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are Republicans and Democrats. First of all, I'm not going to pull the lever for either of those groups. We need to be thinking about something different. I'm in the black community, and I can't see much difference between the two in the two capitalist parties that run things. We've got to understand this is an oligarchy, and why are we participating continually in something that's not going to work for us? This is about creating wealth for a certain group of people, and we're participating in this as some sort of junior partner, and we get some goodies. For example, some people that look like us phenotypically in high places and whatnot, but it doesn't mean anything. We need a complete revolutionary change, and black people have got to stop going down and automatically pulling the lever for either Republican, mostly Democrat candidates. I mean, this is something that has to be changed.
But what is feasible as change right now, do you see, David?
What do I see? as possible.
As feasible.
I would yes. start using that cudgel. I would punish the ruling class in such a way financially that they would have to give up some more benefits. In the past, that is what they've done. They've always dribbled out a few changes to encourage some kind of defense of the attack by any people of color to things like boycotts of businesses and whatnot. But we've got to come out a lot stronger in terms of how we spend our money and demanding that we get something to be given to us if we're going to vote for a particular candidate. We can't just go and vote Democratic because at this time we came from Republican and went to Democrat during the Great Depression. But we can't do that anymore. We've got to do something different, and we've got to punish those people in power, especially with the money that we do have and we do spend.
Now, you were clear about your attitudes as it relates to the Democrats and Republicans. What are your attitudes about third-party candidates parties themselves?
The point is that I haven't committed myself to any third-party candidate. Maybe we need our own party, you see. As some of these third-party candidates might be just as infected with white supremacy racism. I've met people who call themselves liberal. And then when you talk to them, they're infected with white supremacy racism, just like the virulent KKK people. They're saying stupid things, but, you know, I've learned to pick those things up. You know, so at this point, I would say one of the greatest things would be to start establishing your own parties and taking it over at local level first and then moving on. Right now in New York, the mayor not only has done that, he's also gotten to the point where he's gotten them to give him the head of the schools, the mayor control of schools. I think that should be a local community control of schools. So we've got to force these things. They're doing all kinds of things to take away good things that happened in schools before, because the local people have absolutely no control. This is a dictatorship of the mayor on local issues like schools. I mean, it's terrible. I mean, I know a lot about this. And we've got to step in and make some changes in this respect.
Thank you so much for your contribution today, David. I'm so delighted that you called. And that brings us to the end of our program today. It's always good to pause every now and then, you know, let the madness go on by itself, and then you analyze it, you take a look at it. Because as I said, this race is going to go through a bit more in terms of permutations, but I'll be talking about how the money has begun to filter through. Jeb Bush started with a very modest campaign of $10 million in advertising, and that's just in two states. We'll be talking about how the money is beginning to dribble out, and this will change media coverage of the candidates themselves. It would also force the candidates now, because Jeb Bush has released some money, that $5 billion advertising budget that the media world is looking at to get their healthy chunk of it. And that is what is dictating their coverage right now, the hopes that if they prove their worthiness, they would get, you know, a sympathetic buy from the various candidates. And this is promising to be the most expensive political campaign yet. in the history of the United States, up as many as $5 billion to be spent on marketing and advertising, and that is not including the PACs, the supporting organizations. This is just the candidates themselves. So big-time money. What we're seeing is just a game that the media are playing to prove the buy, to prove the reason that the advertisers, the advertising campaigns should make their buys with them and spend more money. And we are thinking, of course, that what they're providing is journalism and coverage. And as they say in Brooklyn, that ain't it. It's something else. It's big money. And when Jeb Bush, of course, does make this buy, he is changing that equation because, of course, the person that they're looking to at the moment, they've created, the media have just created Donald Trump. They act like they don't know what a story is and what is worthy of coverage and what is not. So something else is accounting for the tone of coverage and the frequency of coverage of certain candidates. And it all has to do with what they think these candidates are likely to spend. And so when they sit down across the table, they'll be able to say, look, we did X number of stories, we gave you X number of headlines, we did X number of interviews, we've done our job as your extension, essentially, of your marketing or PR department and of your campaign as a whole. Now, that is the equivalent of X millions of dollars in free advertising. Now, we're coming to seal the deal. Let's talk money. What are you going to spend? We think we deserve at least 10 to 40% of your budget. That's how it works. That's how it works. They create these candidates. They hand them to you. They reinforce these things with their coverage, which is, of course, very stilted. And it is all about money, driven by money. We'll return to each other tomorrow, God willing, and the creek don't rise, for Free Your Mind Friday. In the meantime, please know, it is a pleasure and a great, great privilege for me to be in your esteemed company. I so value that. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.